program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the Internet. The show is hosted by Felicia King of Quality Plus Consulting and airs the first and third Saturdays of every month.
Good morning, I'm Felicia King, and you're listening to Breakfast Bites. Today's show is going to be about IT contracts, and if I have any time left, we'll be talking about smart TVs and the concerns associated with them. So let's first get started on this whole topic of IT contracts, and you may be wondering, well, why would I even talk about IT contracts? This seems to be something probably fairly straightforward. I mean, IT things are fairly straightforward, you would think. Well, it turns out that all of the challenges that you would normally associate with contracts, as well as all the benefits that you normally derive from having contracts, those definitely all still apply with regards to IT contracts. And I would argue that it's even more important that IT contracts are paid more special attention to than your general types of contracts. And I think that that really resides around the fact that most attorneys are not IT security experts. And let's say you were going to be buying some real estate, you would not be seeking to have a intellectual property attorney necessarily be the one who is helping you purchase that real estate. So that is simply because, you know, that attorney who normally works in intellectual property, that's their specialty, versus having some special knowledge about the real estate industry or real estate transactions. And I would go even further saying that residential real estate is quite considerably different from commercial real estate. So the same thing actually applies with regards to IT contracts. This issue is really quite personal to me because I deal with IT contracts all the time. And I see all the time how they bring clarity to a relationship between a service provider and a client. And they get this, contracts get all of these factors out on the table ahead of time. And they are the primary problem resolution mechanism when just normal, reasonable, rational people talking things out has failed. So the value and the importance of the contract, I think, cannot be underestimated. So let's take an example and kind of analyze it and see what went right and what went wrong. Back in March of 2014, you may recall that the Navy intranet, as well as the Navy's internal network, was hacked. And it was hacked pretty hardcore. It resulted in severe breaches and release of extensive, I mean, something like it, cleanup costs were in excess of $10 million, what it cost the Navy to clean this up. And it was, their network was basically breached by the government of Iran or the people who work for the government of Iran. Now, the analysis of this breach, interestingly enough, led back to the contract that the Navy had with Hewlett-Packard with regards to the implementation of their intranet. And the intranet was originally hacked, so the primary attack vector was a SQL injection attack. And for those of you out there that are IT people, you just probably rolled your eyes sitting there and thinking, oh my gosh, here it is. Yet again, it's the SQL injection attack. You know, some of the reaction that we have is, really? Like, that wasn't patched? I mean, really? What year is it? Anyhow, if you're going to put up a website, seemingly like the number one thing that you need to be penetration testing for is a SQL injection attack. Really? So the analysis of the contract between HP and the Navy, I thought was quite fascinating. It turns out that they did not get IT security professionals involved in the contract negotiations. So because of that, huge chunks of things that should have been in the contract were left out of the contract. I'll give you a metaphor for this. Let's say you put out a request for bid and you say, install some networking in my building. And you never bothered to actually hire somebody to do a design that specifies what that request for bid should actually look like. So you just put out basically garbage as an RFB. So don't be surprised if what you get is three quotes back that are all over the place, that none of them will actually deliver you exactly what you need because you haven't paid anybody to actually do an engineering assessment of what you actually need. And if you think that you can just whip together generic, lame old, non-specific RFBs and put them out there and expect to have good results, then I really think your paradigm is not right with regards to that. A much better approach is to actually hire somebody who is like Bixie certified, as an example, or some sort of IT consultant to design your network specification. Then that can be put into a very specific RFB saying 132 jacks installed 30 inches off of the floor, Cat 6, specify the model number of patch panels, specify ladder rack. I mean, you know, the whole nine yards. Even color of the cabling makes a difference. Yes, it does. If you don't have an engineering design that goes into your RFB, then what you will get back is three quotations from vendors to put in this networking cabling. And they won't even remotely be comparable because you haven't given them any engineering design to work off of. Well, the same thing applies here. How can we write a contract that specifies what should and should not be included in an intranet design for the Navy when you haven't gotten the IT security people involved? So who is defining the network, the engineering parameters? Who is defining what good enough is? Who is defining what will be checked? What are the QC steps? What is the definition of done? Is done simply people can log into the intranet? Does done include the intranet has certain levels of backups and it has recovery time objectives and disaster avoidance and recovery plans and there's documentation for it? Does it include a pass evaluation on something like a Kali level penetration test? Well, again, if you don't have the IT security people involved providing the attorneys that level of detail that needs to be included in the contracts, then what you will get is garbage as a result. And again, I deal with contracts all the time, and I can tell you that you need to be very specific in the contracts about what done looks like. For example, let's say you were implementing an SMTP relay server, and you could say, okay, well, the consultant is going to train the on-site IT manager how to manage the SMTP relay server. There will be the implementation of a certificate. There will be testing of outbound email with Wireshark to verify that it's actually leaving the server in an encrypted format. Screenshots of the encrypted email transmission will be captured and logged and yada yada. And then that's like the end of it. So if you don't define specifically what done looks like to that level of detail in the contract, well, then somebody can come back later on and say, well, but the open relay settings aren't correct. Well, okay, maybe they're not, but that's not the problem of the consultant. That is the responsibility of the on-site IT manager in order to configure that. They received the training on how to do that. Then they need to configure that. So the other thing that the contract really does is it defines roles and responsibilities very clearly. And again, if you don't have the technical people involved during the contract formation and negotiation phases, then you will end up with a garbage contract. So let's go back to this Navy hack example. Edward Ferreira, an analyst for Forrester Research, is quoted as saying, these types of poorly written contracts in IT are common. Many vendors interpret contracts in a strict sense, and if the contract did not explicitly call for the remediation of vulnerabilities, then it is more than possible that the vendor would have allowed the vulnerabilities to continue, which enabled the resultant breach. Now, another gentleman, Al Pasquale, from Javelin Strategy and Research, said one way for companies to avoid missing systems in service contracts is to create a network schematic that both parties reference. I think this is a phenomenal idea. And again, I work with organizations all the time where the intent is to be able to provide them service. And absolutely, the first step is, okay, what does your stuff look like? How does it fit together? Let's try and get on the same page. And so that's what this statement is about, that a network schematic needs to exist so that both parties can reference that and be on the same page. Well, you can imagine that this would be absolutely critical to contract negotiations as well. Simply the definition of, let's say, for example, you put in your contract that the contract included the decommission of Exchange. Well, what does that mean? Does that mean the entire on-premise Exchange infrastructure is included? Or is it just something like a single hybrid server? Right? That level of detail needs to be provided. Now, if you actually had a network schematic that both parties could reference during the creation of the contract, then something like that, that level of detail would be very easy to include. And again, unless it's the technical people that are negotiating out what is and is not in this contract, then you're going to miss very, very relevant details like that. So El Pasquale, he continued on, and he said that organizations should look to ensure that the responsibility for securing systems is clearly specified in the contract. He analyzed the Navy hack, and he was addressing the fact that, well, not only was there no network schematic that the parties could agree to and reference to, but also the IT people and the security people were left out of the contract negotiations. And that there were no defined roles and responsibilities for who was doing the follow-up or hardening work. I mean, one of the problems in the Navy contract with HP was that it didn't even specify who was going to be doing the design and implementation and verification of a disaster avoidance and recovery system. So it clearly also did not include who was going to be securing the systems. And it should be noted that because securing systems is a very, very dynamic moving target. I mean, there is not a day that goes by that I'm not adjusting some setting or looking at something security related and analyzing, oh, this is a new breach that's going on, or there's this vulnerability in the wild. How do we have to adapt to that? I mean, this is literally an enormously dynamic environment we live in with regards to security threats. So it would be very naive to think that you could specify roles and responsibilities in the contract that says that the consulting firm, in this case HP with the Navy attack, would implement, you know, would have the roles and responsibility for securing the intranet system. And then that's the end of it. A better approach would be to say, yes, they have the responsibility for doing the initial securing and then penetration testing so that you have a baseline to work from. But you could even go so far as to say that, okay, well, we would like you to also document or create a certain baseline procedure that the ongoing IT support at the Navy would use on a regular scheduled basis in order to pen test the site, penetration test, and then take remediative actions. And based upon their risk profile, they would need to specify, and when I say they, I mean the Navy, would have to actually specify their own risk profile for how frequently those penetration tests needed to go on. I mean, is this something that you purchase licensing for Nessus and you run that on a weekly basis, and it generates reports for then IT security staff at the Navy to analyze and remediate? So simply securing it from the date of implementation itself is also an incomplete solution, but the really shocking thing is that in this Navy contract, it was not even specified whose role and responsibility it was to secure those systems from the get-go. So, there are some other very actionable advice components that were delivered in this article from March 2014 that I thought was very interesting. Ferreira, you remember Edward Ferreira, the analyst for Forrester Research, he says that specifying what is not in the contract is just as important as what is covered, and I couldn't agree more. So, quote, he says, "I always recommend clients build a detailed requirements traceability matrix to track the explicit requirements for each contract, defining the service to be performed, the service levels expected, and the environment, network, application, or host that that service will be performed with or on. And liability and indemnification should be clearly defined." So let's break that down. So he's talking about a traceability matrix. And that's great. Now, I don't know if he was envisioning that as literally a table specified inside the contract. I would think that that would make that very clear and readable. And I would think you'd have to go to that level of detail. So he says, specify the service to be performed, what service levels are on those, on the network, the application, or the host, and who will be performing that, and what is that service that it's on. So let's break this down. Let's take an example of here is this web server, and specifically, the contract would address the service on that server that hosts the Navy Intranet website. And the service level expected would be that it would pass penetration tests and it would have perhaps certain uptime requirements and have certain levels of redundancy built into the design and load balancing and these sorts of things. And it should also very clearly specify, and he articulates it as liability and indemnification, but I would also say before you can start with liability and indemnification, you have to define roles and responsibilities. So, for example, in this case, it would say HP consulting staff responsible for implementing and documenting the particular web hosting service on said web hosting server or cluster. It's probably more like a group of servers that were providing that function. And then, documenting out how all those pieces work together, how the five nines of uptime, the Six Sigma levels of uptime are met, and that it was their role and responsibility to do that, as well as to document it, and who's going to be responsible to correct issues if those services go down, and these sorts of things. And with regards to liability and indemnification, there is oftentimes a clause in there if the contract is about something like a hosting or a maintenance service, there's oftentimes a clause in there that says, well, the base organization will end up losing, let's just use a round number, $50,000 per hour. So if, and the acceptable outage for this service is 1 hour. So if the consulting firm is unable to get this website back up within 1 hour, then these are the financial penalties for that. Okay, so that's the liability being clearly defined. Literally putting financial penalties on there and service level agreements and those sorts of things. Now, my advice to you is to be very careful with those things. Use that sparingly and use it only when it's appropriate. If you try to put financial penalties in there where it isn't really absolutely critically necessary to do so, then either you will find a shortage of vendors who will be willing to accept that contract for service, or you will find that your price point for that contract is significantly higher than it would be otherwise. So where that level of uptime and financial penalties makes sense for service contracts with investment banking firms, you know, or very, very, very large corporations, and that's probably not going to make sense for a mid-sized organization. It's just not. And while you may think, oh, well, that'll protect us, and then that'll give me money back if the vendor can't get things back up in time. Yes, that's probably true. However, at what cost to you? Does that mean that you are paying a significantly higher fee because that was a component of the contract that you required? Now, I mean, if you actually have a legitimate business need for that and you can afford to pay more for service because what you're trying to do is liability and risk shift to your vendor, well, again, then that's your prerogative. It's your money. But I'm just suggesting be careful how you use that tool in your toolbox. Another fascinating thing that I saw out of this analysis of the Navy hack with regards to IT contracts is that they specified that contracts should also have clearly defined processes for resolving problems and list the key decision makers. I thought that was fantastic because I almost never actually see this in IT contracts. I mean, what you oftentimes are seeing is some sort of reference to the American Arbitration Association. Well, I think it would be beneficial to actually specify out what needs to happen prior to going to arbitration. And I think that was really what this analysis was alluding to. It wasn't just suggesting, oh, well, make sure that you're including the default arbitration code in your, you know, or verbiage in your contract. No, instead, literally take the time to figure out what is the process for resolving problems and list the key decision makers who will be responsible for being the point person for the negotiations for each party to the contract. I thought that was an excellent point, and it really costs you nothing to have that in the contract. Spelling out responsibilities on both sides is pivotal to avoiding future problems. Another analyst said when he looked at the contract, he says, if you write a contract, you have to make it idiot-proof because the other side will follow it exactly to the letter and not more because everyone is under a profit pressure. I would actually agree with that to probably about a 95%. There is still a certain level of ethics and integrity that a lot of organizations have with regards to quality of service, and their intent is to say that no matter what, we will provide at least this level of quality with regards to XYZ that we've implemented. But realize that, of course, if they did not properly bid the project, then what may be happening is that, yeah, they are under profit pressure where they don't have enough hours in the project or enough compensation in the project to compensate for the number of hours that it would actually take to do the project right. And you, as a consumer of these contracts, you need to be explicitly aware of this particular challenge. Because if your vendor is going to be under undue profit pressure, I mean, sure, everyone's under profit pressure. The question is, will that make them cut corners? That's what you have to ask. And so this goes back to the whole thing of, if you're looking for a specific level of quality, then you need to have that specific level of quality actually defined in the contract. And the more specific you can get with the definition of what completeness looks like, such as, well, I have verified that this server is working by doing these tests, and if it passes these tests, then the server is defined as working. I mean, you literally need to get that specific, because if you don't, then if you're dealing with a service provider who is not driven by their own ethics, then you could be getting an incomplete solution, and I will just tell you flat out, that's oftentimes what I have seen. More often than not, I've seen that in the IT consulting industry. Now, there clearly are ethical consulting firms out there who will just do what's right because that is the ethics and the belief system and the morals of their company. But there's certainly plenty that are not driven by that whatsoever, and I've seen just outright breaches of contracts. I've seen outright corner cutting, and it's not just the IT consulting industry. I've seen it in, you know, the trades, the construction trades, and plenty of others. So this, again, behooves you to know your contract, have things specifically defined in your contract about what it looks like to be done, who is responsible for resolving problems, what each party is responsible to do, and try to create some sort of documentation that shows what your systems look like so that between yourself and your service provider, you can come up with, you can have a common talking point during the contract negotiation phase. Say, oh, I have these three servers and this network and these two sites, and this is what I want you to do to all of these things, and specifically list out roles and responsibilities, and you have to define what done looks like. And if you don't specify that, then your provider will specify that definition for you. And from the provider's perspective, I can tell you that usually I will define what done looks like as well. For example, again, let's go back to the SMTP relay. I tested it, did the outgoing sending email to the upstream smart host, analyzed it with Wireshark to verify that the email was leaving the server in an encrypted fashion. It was. Here's the screenshots of it. Therefore, it is now complete. So you should be involved in that discussion about what complete looks like. And if the service provider's definition of complete is different than yours, well, then I pretty well guarantee you, you're going to have problems in the future. And so the intent here is to avoid those problems simply by getting on the same page from the very beginning. And that is what the contract is defined or is designed to help you do. So I hope you've enjoyed this and learned an awful lot in the process, and I'll talk to you in a couple weeks.
You've been listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the Internet. The show airs the first and third Saturdays of every month and is hosted by Felicia King. To contact Felicia, visit her website, qualityplusconsulting.com. Support comes from Gene's Jazz Series at the Racine Theater Guild, celebrating Valentine's Day with Victor DeLorenzo, Jan-